I wanted us to carry away from this evening an image of, never mind, of just how obtuse the disciples seem to be at this point in the story, at least as obtuse as Pamphilus' character in the video. Just completely in denial of what Jesus is trying to say. And that it's not like it's not in front of them. It's not like it's not acted out. It's right there. We've been following the parables basically as the book of Matthew tells them. And in Matthew, Jesus has just finished, as we come to the parable that we're going to look at today, this parable of the lost sheep. Jesus has just finished telling his disciples in so many words that he's going to die. And they, however, and this is also a major theme that we've been talking about to this point, they have just recognized, like just recognized in Jesus, the, if you want, merit or legitimacy of his claim to be the Messiah. So they've just kind of keyed on the fact that this guy is that guy. And one of the ways they've keyed on it is because early in Jesus' public work, he does all these things that they look at and think, that's it, that's how we want a Messiah to behave. We want a Messiah to do magic. We want a Messiah to fix things by just zapping them. That's how a Messiah should behave. That's what Messiahs do. That's what God does. He zaps things better. This guy can zap things better. Ding, 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 Messiah. And right on the heels of that, as Jesus kind of works his way through that and realizes, if I keep going down this path, not the kind of Messiah that I'm actually supposed to be. I'm actually a left-handed Messiah, not a right-handed Messiah. Right in the middle of that transition, he starts talking about his own death. And the disciples just basically say, let's talk instead about how things are going to be when you come into power. And that's what sets up this whole parable, is the disciples having this conversation about when Jesus comes to power by his right hand, who's going to be closest to him? Who's going to be the greatest? And Jesus, of course, as we touched on at the end of last week, responds by bringing this child into the middle of the group, not to illustrate that we need to be sweet, simple, or charming to gain the love of God, but actually to illustrate what it means to be losers. That is Jesus not ignoring the question of who's going to be the greatest. In fact, he answers it quite directly, the way he has it in Matthew's text, as Jesus says, he who is the least, which the actual original language word there would be just as well translated littlest among you is the one who is great. So it's not that the question doesn't get answered. It's that the disciples are in denial. They just can't accept the answer. So much so that one of the other gospel accounts, John, one of the disciples, just changes the subject. He just goes somewhere else. It's kind of like the ADD moment in this whole thing, right? Hey, look, master, there's this guy. And he's been doing miracles. He's been casting out demons, but he hasn't been with us. And so we told him to shove off. Now, this is not the parable that we're headed for, but it's part of what gives it context. And it's pretty fascinating in its own right. So we're going to pause just for a minute. Because, as I've said before, Jesus didn't come to start a religion. And I would stand by that perspective. And in light of a moment like this one in the story, I would want to add that Jesus not only didn't come to start a religion, not least of all because he's barely given anyone a real reason to suspect that he might be the sort of Messiah you could build a religion around. And he's no sooner barely done anything like that than his disciples have already gone off full speed ahead to make a religion. So he doesn't even need to, even if he had come to do that, because his disciples are full on doing it already. And this little story is a great example of that. Not only is John in denial about what Jesus is trying to teach about the path to world changing being a downward one, John is already starting to operate out of the exact kind of structures that Jesus has absolutely no use for. That's fascinating. It's like John is saying, there's this guy that we saw and he's doing good things. He's doing the kind of good things that you do. He's casting out evil spirits. But he isn't part of the tribe. He has no credentials. He has no license. He doesn't even have the merit badge for official exorcism. Like, he doesn't have any of the things that he's supposed to have to do the stuff that the people that are with the Messiah do. So, we said he should go. Jesus is pretty dismissive about that. He really is. He says if he's not against you, he's for you. Those are the words we have on the page. And we could travel pretty far in terms of implications just from that moment alone in terms of religious attitude and behavior. We're not going to do that, but if you want to have a reflective homework kind of moment, all you have to do is sit down for a couple of quiet minutes and then just write out a short list. Maybe it'll be a long list, but write out a list of people whose religious beliefs are, as far as you can tell, nothing like yours. And then just ask yourself, when you got the list, just ask yourself how you think God feels about whatever good they're up to. And you're in the same terrain as this story. That's how that story goes. And that can be interesting, because what Jesus is saying here is essentially that not one of the acceptability tests that John has in mind matter at all when it comes to Jesus' way of going about the business of what he called the kingdom. None of them. That's fascinating to me. In contemporary sociological terms, we might call those acceptability tests boundary markers. They're the kind of things that define in-groups and out-groups, right? I want you to think for a moment about what sort of things you might have been taught growing up. What sort of things you might have been taught defined who is in and who is out in whatever religious context you grew up in. This is not a negative exercise. We're going to take this somewhere. But I invite you to actually think about that and tell me what some of those were. What were some of the boundary markers for who's in and who's out? By the way, Christianity does not have a corner on this practice.
Christianity until I heard out that the Mennonites thought the same thing. And that was such an amusing shocker to me. It's like, oh good, we all think we're all better than everyone else. Which is just wrong. We knew that as a kid.
Yeah.
And that's why I found it funny when some friends said,
so just belonging to the group with that name was sort of the boundary marker, being a Catholic, being a Mennonite.
Well,
is that...
apparently I didn't know that until I was quite recently. And I feel absolved of my guilt for thinking that, as a Catholic, we were...
the elite.
Like snobism. And so yeah. It kind of made me feel like, oh good, they're all snobs.
I find it intriguing that you would use that kind of language around that, because that is what, that's sort of how boundary markers behave, right? They're exclusive, inclusive. Yeah. What else? Any others? They can be as gargantuan or as trivial as come to mind. Ray.
One of the things my mother did, she's very religious, is that she would show up on the weekend and go pissed off and do whatever they did Saturday night and call home over Sunday morning. She insisted they get up and go to church. Go to church.
Church attendance was a boundary marker.
It was about appearances.
Okay.
It goes back to Jesus' time and continues to this day. Somehow it's what things appear to be is more important than what they really are.
Yeah, lots of great pop music, or memorable pop music, generated about the gap between Saturday night and Sunday morning. Any others?
I was forced to go to church on Sundays when I was a kid. I didn't go to church, I would maybe ride my bicycle.
Yeah.
Gotta
find the right lever, eh?
Right? It was boring.
Well, if we keep going, I know we all have things that come to mind, some of them things that we don't even want to say, but if we keep going, the next thing Jesus does to give us context for the parable of the lost sheep is to offer us what has become another well-known text, but often I think misunderstood. The text is, if anyone scandalizes one of these little ones who believes in me, it would be better for him to have a great millstone tied around his neck and be sunk to the bottom of the sea. That's familiar to most of us, right? Most of us heard the text and have some frame of reference for it. Can anybody give me any context in which they've heard that applied? Like, to whom should that millstone be assigned?
Well,
There's sort of some classics, it seems to me, but I just wanted to test my thinking about that a little bit. Pedophiles, yeah. Exactly, Tim. This is what's curious about this text in the context in which we find it, because we find it in a stream of things that Jesus lays out headed toward this pair of parables of the lost sheep and the lost coin. And he's talking about lostless and lastness and leastness all the way along. And the obvious referent in the text for the little one that Jesus is talking about is actually, sequentially, it's not the child. It's actually the unlicensed exorcist.
John?
You have to bounce back and forth between the Gospels to get the whole sequence. But the sequence, if you lay the whole sequence of the stories out, when you combine all the Gospels, the story that precedes that text is the story of the disciples, of John saying, this guy shouldn't be doing this because he's not one of us. And then Jesus says, whoever scandalizes the least of these. That's the way the stories fall out. I find that intriguing because it's easy to misunderstand or misplace that given the relative proximity of that and use of little in our 19th century, never mind 21st century, understanding that a child is a sweet little thing when Jesus is actually offering the child as an example of a loser. This is the most proximate loser. This is the most proximate least one in the story to that saying of Jesus. This is the person that doesn't match the religious boundary markers. And just a little original language moment here. The word that gets translated scandalized in the Bible means a bunch of different things in different settings. There's obvious renderings of it that include and that we're familiar with. Stumble, sin, give up their faith, give offense or scandal, throw difficulties in someone's way. When we take that all together, it seems to me almost more like Jesus is saying to those that would walk in the way of Jesus, don't start throwing lack of respectability at people who are trying to do what is good. Because if you send people away from doing good with your religious boundary markers, you send them away from me. And that's a pretty important truth for those of us who live and move in religious land, among other things, to hear and to be reminded of. I don't know if we can actually really overstate the implications of this. What happens if we take seriously the idea that Jesus is saying that enlisting on the side of those that look like the world's winners is actually stepping away from the littlest and the least, and that the littlest and the least are the people who hold the keys to the kingdom? It's rather serious implications of that idea, I think. And I guess it shouldn't come as a surprise to us, really, that it takes some work for us to try to imagine this, because the people that were right on the scene, that were watching Jesus try to work it out, and watching Jesus try to figure out how to illustrate it so those nearest to him, and eventually anyone who wished to walk in the way of Jesus could try to get it, they're taking a while to catch on as well. So maybe we shouldn't be shocked. We shouldn't be surprised. Anyway, what I said in the blurb was that we were going to explore the parable of the lost sheep, and so far that hasn't happened. But I think what we're going to see in a moment is that it's all of a piece, that this stuff is all actually quite entangled in the way Jesus is doing what he's doing. And that the core truth of what the parable of the lost sheep is about has actually kind of come to light in what Jesus is doing to put it into its place before he even tells the story. So we've mostly been following the progression leading up to this parable, mostly in the shape that Matthew gives it. But if we were going to duck into Luke's telling of the story for a bit, we would find that it puts the same emphasis on losers, but it does it in a really different way. Luke says that the tax collectors and the sinners were coming to hear Jesus, and that the religious leaders were grumbling about that because they didn't like him hanging around with what? With losers. From whose perspective? The people who make up the boundary markers for religion. Quote, in Luke, this man welcomes outcasts and even eats with them. Eating being the intimate thing that it is when we share it with others. And so, as a result of that complaint, says Luke, Jesus told them this parable. That parable is the parable of the lost sheep. Lost, last, least. We've got to rethink what we think lost means to get this parable. Most of us know the outlines of the story well. There's this hypothetical situation that Jesus offers. There's a shepherd, he has 100 sheep. One of whom is lost, wouldn't he, Jesus says, leave the 99, other 99 on the mountain or in Luke in the desert and go to look for the stray? By the way, this is not a primer on how to be a successful sheep farmer, because if you know even a little bit about sheep and how stupid they are, you know that leaving 99 sheep on the side of a hill is going to lead to 99 more lost sheep. Like, that's just what's going to happen. That's not the point. It's rhetorical. And so we just need to remember that. partly because of its implications later in the parable. The point is about the saving paradox of lostness, not about foundness. Jesus is making the point that the shepherd in this parable is so ridiculously good, so bizarrely committed to finding the lost, that even if all 100 sheep get lost, it's not going to be a problem because this shepherd is in the business of looking for the lost, for the last, for the least. That's what this shepherd does. That's who this shepherd is. And I don't think it would be unfair to make the point that this is the world that we live in, that the 99 persons who, just persons who need no repentance, Jesus kind of tosses out this phrase later in the story, that's a rhetorical device. Those people don't exist. And all it takes to know that that's the case is an honest conversation with another human about the shape of their life and mine. There's no such persons. So that changes the shape of the story, doesn't it? And it's one of the things that I find the most challenging about many of the contemporary shapes of Western Christianity. We put so much energy into trying to look like we've got our shit together, like we're winners. Or if we're hard-pressed, what we do is we turn Jesus into the one that turns us losers into winners, which is the same commitment to being seen as winners, just with a religious gloss. Like it's just kind of a three dressed up as a nine, you know? And this is what Jesus has just been hammering away at. He's been hammering away at the fact that he, the core of the story that forms the genesis of what we now think of as Christianity, is not a winner. That he is operating on the margins of the story, not just of religion, but of human experience and of history. And that that's where he is functioning. That is where the messianic work of Jesus is going to happen. So why? If there's some merit to that perspective that I'm taking on these parables, why do we keep coming back to these ideas of looking like a winner with such incredible insistence? Why are we so committed to this? Why do the churches that get the press in religion land look so much like the mall or like other markers of what the surrounding culture calls success when the person at the center of this story is so clearly saying this is not what it's about? Like, why? Because we don't even trend that way. We just live there. You know, we're just really committed to that as humans. Well, perhaps partly because that is the story shape that as humans we find plausible. We find that believable. We find ourselves able to comprehend and apprehend that idea. And even if we have to kind of circle around it from the back, well, he kind of looks like a loser, but in the end he's a winner. Eternally, he's a winner. Someday, he's a winner. Somewhere, he's a winner. And by association, me too. Even if we have to do that, we go there. Is it in the end because the idea that the path to change is this path that goes through the extremity of death, that really we can't imagine that? We just can't. Maybe it's because the other story is so believable and so likely. It's what we want to believe because it fits our preferences, because we sense that we can live in it, and if we go live in that other story, the story that says Jesus makes winners out of losers, that we can look like we have our stuff all sorted, and that feels pretty good. Right? It's nice to feel good. The point is not that the path Jesus is describing is the path to feeling lousy. This is intriguing about this parable, because if we keep going in the parable, Jesus is saying, in the end, this path of this shepherd, this bizarrely good shepherd, finding and carrying home the lost, the least, is the path to enormous, tremendous celebration and joy. I find it intriguing that at the end of the parable, of this particular parable, and then Jesus more or less duplicates the story shape of the parable of the lost coin, Jesus says, "Thus I say to you, there is joy before the angels of God over one repentant sinner." Now, there's a whole other thing to explore here that we're not going to explore, which is all the spillage from repentant. Because if you grew up in the Christian church, you know that this verse is a jumping off point for lots of religious stuff. All I'm going to say about it today is that it's a curious thing that in both the parable of the lost sheep and the parable of the lost coin, neither the sheep nor the coin in either of those parables is capable of any repenting at all. None. Zero. Nil. Not a noosh. None. Both the central objects that illustrate lostness in those two parables can do anything in the parabolic setting but hang about in their lostness. That's it. That's all they can do. Their recovery and the subsequent joy that comes from that, the party that ensues, because there's a party in both these stories, depends entirely on the shepherd, in the case of the lost sheep, on the woman's determination in the story of the lost coin. Their determination to find the lost. And so if we insist that the sinner gives up sinning, or that the lost somehow finds themselves before the finder will get off their ass to look for them, then basically we are headed almost directly away from the obvious sense of both of these stories. I think that's intriguing. I think that's actually kind of revolutionary in the land of religion, as I've encountered it. I heard an interesting news item this past week. These two guys, Joshua Fields Milbourne and Ryan Nicodemus are the guys' names. They've just finished writing a second book. They're most commonly known in their public sphere as the Minimalists, a couple of young guys who were happening young professionals. And I'm going to read you, in their own words, a little bit of their story here, just a very brief moment about what led them to the exercise of divesting themselves of a lot of their stuff in terms of how they live. They write on their website, "It all started with a lingering discontent. A few years ago, while approaching age 30, we had achieved everything that was supposed to make us happy. Great six-figure jobs, nice cars, big houses with more bedrooms than inhabitants, pointless masses of toys and scads of superfluous stuff. And yet with all that stuff, we weren't satisfied with our lives. We weren't happy. There was a gaping void. And working 70 to 80 hours a week for a corporation and buying even more stuff didn't fill the void. In fact, it only brought more debt and stress and anxiety and fear and loneliness and guilt and overwhelm and depression. What's worse, we didn't have control of our time and thus didn't control our own lives. So in 2010, we took back control using the principles of minimalism to focus on what's important." Now, the story is fascinating. I mean, one of them does this 21-day thing where he calls his buddy, this other guy, these two guys do this together. He calls his buddy over and he says, he's living as a single guy, not least of all because his mother had died and his marriage had ended in the same month. So he's, you know, on the ropes relationally and emotionally in lots of ways. But he calls his buddy over and he says, "We're going to pack up this whole place like I was going to move. We're going to put it all into boxes. Whole place. And then I'm going to live here for 21 days and I'm only going to unpack the things I need. For 21 days. I'm going to see how much of it's still packed." And at the end of 21 days, 80-some percent of it, I think, just dead, or 90-some percent of it was still in boxes. He just didn't need it to live. So he sold it or gave it away or just got rid of it all. Anyway, it's an interesting story. I'm not making a point about minimalism in this setting, although there's things there for us to learn, I expect. But in our context this evening, this story got my attention because here are two guys that decided that the prevailing, the plausible message about the pathway to success and joy was not only untenable, but just plain wrong, just plain backward. And so they set off down a very different pathway, one that I would say from the dominant vantage point of the culture looks like a pathway down, not a pathway up. It's a pathway into less, not a pathway into more. And that's the path where they found what they're describing as joy. I think that's intriguing. What I want us to do as much as we can when we go away from an exploration like this is keep our imaginations working on the images from the parables. I think it's important both to note what the images do include and what they don't, because they do not include one single note of earning or merit. There's not a breath in these parables about rewarding the rewardable. There's not a hint of correcting the correctable or improving the improvable. There is only the gracious, saving determination of the main characters, all of whom are parabolic surrogates for God. And that determination in each of those characters, shepherd and a woman in our parables today, and other well-known parables of the same shape, a king and a father, their determination is to find the lost and to put them on their shoulders, to carry them home to a great big party. End of story. That's awesome. Peace.